On this episode of Unmanned, we get to speak with Michael Elder, who is the king of silver of Las Vegas, RPA pilot turned entrepreneur who owns the company Hollywood Brotherhood. And with him are two special other guests today, Yo and Brett, who were back in the program back in 1999 and have seen the evolution of the unmanned community. Enjoy.
All right, and welcome to Unmanned. I'm the host, Chris Kelso, and with me are special guests today, Elder, Yo, and Brett. Why don't you all give me a little bit of your background, who you are, and yeah, here we go.
Hey,
Brett, you want to start?
Who'd you say?
Brett? Let's let Brett start.
Yeah, let's let Brett start. I'm a fan of that.
Hey, I'm Brett. I'm a previous
dude.
He's a dude. Previous RPA sensor operator. Spent 14 years in service. The entire time I was RPAs. And even though I was an imagery analyst, I started deployed a lot, went and became an instructor. I did that for about 8 years and then separated after 14 years of service. After that, I became a contractor. Right now I do ground control intercept for test missions. And it's been a great run so far.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
What about you, Yo?
You'll notice the audio for the rest of the episode sounds just a little bit different. And that's because the initial file was corrupted. This can be due to the internet and the fact that we're also recording people across the country or across the world based on our jobs. With that being said, it's a great lesson for beginning podcasters to always record a backup version just in case the initial one doesn't work. The audio still sounds great for the rest of the episode, and I hope you enjoy. Thanks.
Kind of the same. Me and Brett started around the same time. I was in the military for 4 years, and then I got out and was an instructor for launch and recovery for 13 years, and then now I do it as a contractor deployed. I do launch and recovery operations.
Okay, 4 years. Wow. You were the same situation as me. Were you at the FTU? Was that your initial switch over?
I was, uh-huh.
Okay. I think you taught me, actually.
I think I did.
And Elder, why don't you give us your background?
Oh man, I'll do my best. I'm not a reliable source on anything including myself, but I try to do whatever I can. I was in the Air Force. I went to the Air Force Academy, graduated in 2002, flew C-130s. After that, for about 6 or 7 years, and then wanted to live in Vegas, volunteered for RPAs back then when it was a one assignment job, came to Vegas, and never left, eventually after that. Flew Preds and Reapers. Went down to Holloman when they stood up the schoolhouse down there. Got out at 13 years and then started contracting, flying as a contractor still, and started a couple of other businesses, companies at the same time.
So when you separated from Holloman, did you go into the FTU contracting or did you go straight to deployment contracting?
Straight to the I actually went from active duty to a full-time reserve position, but just stayed at Holloman. So really nothing changed. Technically I was on the books as a reservist for a year, so that might have been at like year 12 to 13, and then I got out completely at 13 to go fly for a new contracting company. And I deployed for I tried to deploy for a whole year with that company when they first. Turns out I only did 9 months straight because they wouldn't let us do more at the time, but I'm still with that same company. So I never taught as a contractor, just deployed.
Okay, yeah, you were active duty instructor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you separated after 13 years. What year was that when you separated?
2015.
Okay, so you've been doing the deploy gig then for 5 years.
Yes, yep.
Nine months is pretty respectable.
I wanted to do 12 straight, but in the end, the contracting entity didn't want people to go past nine.
Yeah, that can be. There's another company that only sends their people over for about 6 weeks at a time.
Yeah.
And then they bring them home. So they do 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off. And the reason for that is because they found the employee, after about 6 weeks, stops caring about the job and starts thinking about home and what they miss back home. So that's how they keep their people fresh, I guess. But 9 months straight, that's a long time. I guess you get in the
nine
routine.
Months good, man. I think I could have gone more. I would have liked to. But as it was, I did nine. And then I went to Thailand for 2 months, so I didn't come back to the U.S. for 11 months that first year.
Oh, nice. That's a hell of a break.
Yeah.
And when you came back to the U.S., you were on downtime, right? You had like a month off or something? It's kind of relaxed?
I think I might. Yeah, that's actually true. I had 3 months off, so I went to Thailand for 2 months, and then I came back to the States for a month, and then I just worked into normal rotations of 3 months on, 3 months off.
And you're still doing that? I think that's a pretty normal process throughout the community, is these three-on, three-off, or four-on, four-off deals.
Yep, still doing it.
Has your company given you any leeway to maybe extend or do longer? Is that something that you still want to do, is do an extended tour?
I don't know for sure, man. I feel like they've gotten away from that model. I've never pressed a test on that, really. I've just been doing the three-on, three-off. I don't know if we could do more or not.
In COVID time, sometimes you don't get a choice.
So. Yeah, my last three-month deployment took me 5.5 months. About, so, that's accurate.
Yeah, that's been fair. How was travel coming home?
Coming home was great, actually. I flew, well, getting out of the combat zone was a fiasco. Once I got out of the combat zone, I flew Emirates and American, and my overseas leg was almost totally empty. Had to run of the whole plane. Wow. And all the flights stateside, I went, I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 legs before I got home, but they were all easy. They were all fairly empty.
Well, that's a much different experience than I had. I was not on Emirates. I love Emirates. But I had a packed flight, and it was like a plane from 1970. It was horrible. No amenities.
most of my life is just blind luck. I never have a plan, but it always seems to work out. I also have no expectations. It seems okay.
Nice. So I guess this question does apply to all three of you, because you all have kind of the same time frame, too, about that 13, 14-year mark. What made you all decide to separate, knowing that you were only maybe 5 or 6 years away from a active duty retirement? And anybody can go on this one.
Ooh, can I go first?
Sure.
This is Elder. I really wanted to have long hair.
Mm. Yeah, you were kind of getting away with the regs there for a while. You were skirting it.
Oh, man. One of my proudest moments of my military career is when my hair, like, was down past my chin, but still in rags every time I went to work. Used about a whole bottle of hairspray every morning.
Brett didn't have to worry about that. So, Brett, what was your reason?
So, my reason, I took a 365 tour to Afghanistan to work for NATO. I was at the IJC. It was great. And when I went there, I was promised a follow-on Back to Creech.
Okay.
Well, after about 2 weeks of being there, I called my first sergeant, and they said that I never turned in the paperwork for my follow-on, which was the first thing I did, actually, and they denied my follow-on. So I was there for a year, knowing that I was there for no reason whatsoever.
Mm.
When I came home, they wanted to send me to South Dakota, and I was like, nah, my son lives in Vegas. I'm going to move back to Vegas. So I got out, and I decided to become a contractor. So that's the
reason I came back and I got out. I miss it. I miss it every day. I miss uniform. I miss the job. I miss the mission. But I think what I do now is very important, and it's a lot of fun. So.
Okay. That's a good reason to come back for family.
Yep. My son's very important. Or he was. Now he's 19, and I really care less.
Oh, I think I heard a beer crack.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. This is not a Drunken Drones episode, but let's go with it. What are you drinking?
We got some Jameson and some Canada Dry going. Brett's got some moonshine and some Coke going. Coca-Cola.
I made the moonshine into whiskey, so it's actually whiskey and Coke.
We're about to start making whiskey.
Uh-oh.
Legally.
Next business. It really
is going to be part of Hollywood Brotherhood soon.
That sounds fun. We'll talk about that in a sec. All right, yo, I want to hear your reason for separation when you were so close.
So I was only in for 4.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's right.
The reason I got out was because I wanted to finish school, and there wasn't a lot of time because I was deploying a lot after 9/11. I was actually I landed in Kuwait the day of 9/11, and then we moved our entire operation to Pakistan. So I was deploying a lot and doing a lot with that. So I got out to finish school, and I became a contractor. So since then, I got my bachelor's and my master's degree, and I'm just doing contracting now.
So when you finished your degrees, was there a thought of coming back in and going through OTS since you had only done 4 years?
I looked into it. It just never was good timing with my family. I have 2 kids, so there was never a good time to be away from them as long as I would need to. So I chose to just continue contracting and doing now the 3 months on, 3 months off. That works a lot better.
Yeah, so that was going to be my next question. Why did you leave the FTU and go GOCO? And this is a very common question that gets asked to me because I was at the FTU for 10 years and I went GOCO. And people seem to have a problem with, or not a problem, but people seem to have an inquisitive nature on why someone would leave such a secure, I wouldn't say, it's an easy job, right? You're at home every night, it's an easy job. Why leave the comfort of a FTU to go to a deployed combat zone again?
I was there 13 years, and I really believe in what we do overseas as well. I missed the combat part of it. I missed being involved in a squadron. And I was kind of tired of doing the same thing every day, honestly. So I needed a change. And then with me being gone for 3 months at a time, I actually have more quality time with my kids when I'm home. Mm-hmm. Than I did actually working every day because my schedule changed every day, sometimes 2 o'clock in the morning, anywhere to, 8 o'clock at night. So it's actually, I feel more stable. I know when I'm coming and going usually, COVID aside, and I really enjoy what I do.
Your reasoning is pretty much almost exactly the same as mine. So I completely understand that mentality. With the work schedule,
especially being a female, I've gotten a lot of crap for how I leave my children, but it's the same for a man to leave their children. It's hard for anybody to leave their kids and do what we do, but I believe in the mission and I believe what we do.
I agree with you, and I don't think anyone will ever understand exactly what that's like until they've been in that situation. Mm-hmm. So let's pivot back to Elder on this one. You have started how many businesses?
I have one main business, I suppose, Hollywood Brotherhood that you mentioned before, but I kind of have ADD and am a serial idea-er. I try to start a business about every freaking day with somebody. The guys came to set up the movie theater today, and now we're gonna go have some drinks in the next couple of days and talk about business with him and some of his car buddies from work. So I don't know. I just have a bunch of ideas, man. I try to do whatever I can. Sometimes it works. A lot of times it doesn't. But I have like 10 ideas on the plate at any one time.
Yeah, I get the same shit from my wife, and rightfully so. I kind of start something. I start a business or I start some sort of venture, and then a couple months later, I kind of get bored with it. I'm like, hey, I'll start something else, and then I just go on to another project. When really, I should probably focus, you know, at least more into what I had originally created. So I understand.
Dude, that. I would like to talk about stuff like that with you a lot, actually, because that's one of the problems that I've found, too, is I've got a bunch of good ideas. Brett and I are doing stuff together. Yo and I, we've done stuff with other people that we work with, people that I meet every day. Like, I try to do stuff repeatedly, but the hardest thing is just keeping the motivation going to, like, push through and break through the barrier and keep it going. Hollywood Brotherhood broke through and stayed around, and it's still doing okay. But a lot of other stuff is just, you know, in various stages of potential.
Mm-hmm. So let's go with Hollywood Brotherhood for right now. I guess my first question, you obviously have an entrepreneurial mindset because you know, you're an idea guy and you want to start something and then you just go and do it. Why did you start Hollywood Brotherhood? What is it about? Why were you interested in it? You know, what's that process look like? You know, tell me about this company.
Hollywood Brotherhood, if you ask most people, it probably is presented mostly like a jewelry company, making sterling silver, you know, like silver, gold, platinum, rock and roll style, you know, like motorcycle, biker style jewelry. But that wasn't really the original idea. That's what's done the best, and that's what I've followed the most. But I was an English major at the academy. I've always been more left-brained than right. I think that's how that goes, right? Left-brained if you're artistic. Is that right?
I do not know.
I think so.
I'm the opposite.
Yeah. Well, I am kind of the opposite of most of the dudes that we worked with in the military, especially pilots and stuff, because I am very fuzzy and not analytical and not math oriented, and I'm pretty sure that's more left brained. I'm right brained. Oh my
yeah.
God.
Yep.
But that's kind of the point. That's kind of the point is I don't even care which one's right. We'll just go with it. But I've always been more artistic than analytical. So I really decided to start a business that I wanted it to be an art collective. Like, I wanted to get a whole group of people together, which turns out is pretty fucking hard. but I wanted to get a whole group of people together that did, like, various types of artistic things and create, like, a brotherhood of different artists. So we were going to do, and we still are in some form or fashion, but we were going to do jewelry and clothing and fine art and motorcycles and cars and I'm sure I'm forgetting stuff, music, all kinds of stuff. And it was going to be an art collective of a bunch of different dudes under one umbrella business. But I started with something that I was really interested in, which was sterling silver jewelry. And it did really well in the beginning, kind of by chance. And then I just followed that to where it's probably been literally 5 years. I started it almost the same time that I got out of the Air Force. And all 5 years have been consumed with me just trying to make enough jewelry.
And I do not know anything about silver or jewelry or that process. How hard is it to make one of these rings?
It's certainly a learning process. It took me a long time in the beginning. I do it in a different way than a lot of other companies, which I'm actually really proud of, and that's cool. But we can talk about that later.
Sure.
Short answer is, when I first design a ring, from the time I draw it and the time I design the idea on paper, It's probably about a 2-month process to get it made, to get it finalized for the first ring. And after that, once we have it down, we can make reproductions of the same design in 3 days to a week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a steep curve of learning, but the timeline is really fast once you get it down.
I'm assuming then that you draw this, you create some sort of mold or cast for this, or...
So ultimately what we do is called lost wax casting.
Okay.
And that's where you make the first example as a piece of wax carved as a ring, and it looks just like the ring you're going to end up with, but it's in wax. You then put that in a plaster mold, and you do a process to put molten silver into it, or gold or platinum or whatever, mm-hmm. and the wax sublimates, the wax disappears, melts out, and it's such a hot process that it sublimates and evaporates, and you're left with gold or silver or platinum fill in the void that the wax was inside of the mold, and that gives you your ring. You have to finish it from there. You got to polish it. You got to clean it up. You got to antique it. You got to finalize everything, but that's the basic process.
Now, when you do a ring that, say, like maybe a skull, for example, how do you get the different color from the silver to like the black of the eyes?
What you see on most sterling silver jewelry, which we have here, everybody's wearing shit right now, but it does look like white and black, you know, silver and black.
Mm-hmm.
But the black that you see, you can get two different ways. In the very beginning, it's just an antiquing. It's a chemical process that you paint and polish the silver with, and it kind of permanently puts the recesses and the folds and the crevices and everything, it turns them black, as if it's aged. And that creates the contrast that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The other way that happens is based off of your body. With silver especially, it will react to different people's bodies different ways. So based on what you eat, based on your chemical makeup, based on how healthy you are, shit like that, it will patina and age and turn colors differently, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it means that everyone has a very unique ring, essentially.
Yeah, we do some other stuff with the rings that I'm kind of proud of, that makes everyone literally one of a kind. So we do have standard designs. There's, like you said, there's our version of a skull ring. There's a hellhound ring, which is kind of like a dragon dog. There's a Statue of Liberty pissed off America ring. So we make those all the time, but each one is its own casting. So each one is technically one of a kind.
Wow.
Which I really like. Not no other companies, but very few other companies do that.
Now, does that mean that for each one of these rings, you have to do its own unique wax mold?
That's one thing that most companies don't do that I'm really proud of. Brett just mentioned it too, but all of our rings are numbered. And that turned into a whole thing with Hollywood Brotherhood too, where we have members, everybody goes by their number. It's literally like a big club. And everybody has a serial number or a call sign, kind of like the military, which makes sense for us.
Mm-hmm.
But I do every ring from start to finish as its own. So what other companies do is they'll make a mold and they'll use that mold 1,000 times, 2,000 times. And every time they use the mold, they lose quality and they lose definition. And it becomes cheaper and cheaper over time until they have to destroy the mold and make new ones. We don't do that at all. We make a single mold for a single ring, and it's like as fresh and crisp as the first one I made every single time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And that gives your customer, or I should say your member, a sense of, you know, that uniqueness, that belonging. Like, yeah, this is for me. This is my shit. Nobody else is ever going to have this. And I think that's really, really cool.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that people have reacted really well to. Everybody really likes the fact that they have their own ring that's one of a kind, that has their member number in it, and everybody, you know, goes by that name. And it is kind of like a squadron in the Air Force in a way, or, you know, it's like a motorcycle club, or it's like any, you know, like group of people that not everybody can just automatically be a part of. Which is one of the things that we took from the military, and one of the things that I really like about Hollywood Brotherhood. But yeah, it costs a lot more to do it that way, so it cuts into the profit. Mm-hmm. But that's also what makes it better, and that's why people react to it, because they're getting the absolute best product they can get every time, and it's personalized for them at the same time.
Yeah, and you can have a higher price point, too, because each one of these is individually custom-made.
I'll drink to that, thank you.
Yeah, and so that, you know, that I think rolls in real well with the business side of, you know, like you said, you might not be getting the best profit margin, but at the end of the day, that person is willing to pay a higher price because they know they're getting one-of-a-kind item, and the inclusivity of them being in part of this brotherhood. How many members do you have right now? And Yo and Brett, which number are you?
So I was the first one to buy a ring from Elder here, and so he has rings 1 through 4. So I or 1 through 3. So I'm actually HB4. So I have probably the lowest ring out there, other than what Mike has.
Yeah.
What Elder has.
Brett is essentially number two, but 1 through 3 were test runs and refining the process and getting it down, and I still have them. So Brett was the first dude to support me, and he paid a good price to test it out and get it going for us, and I really appreciated it. So that's why he's such a big part of everything.
That's awesome.
he paid ugly.
What about you, Yo?
I'm number 14.
Okay. And do you all do, I mean, does this brotherhood get together and have events or do things of that nature?
That's funny you should ask that, dude. That's the goal, man. We got people all over the U.S. and a few in Europe as well.
Wow.
Oh, in Asia? Now, we kind of have people, Russia. We got people all over the world, to be honest with you.
That's awesome.
One of the things that I was planning was to start doing like a yearly Hollywood Brotherhood reunion type thing. And I planned it for 2020, which turned out to be Armageddon.
Everybody plans shit this year, and it's fucked us all.
So I guess we're going to do that one in 2021.
Yeah, yeah, if COVID 2.0 doesn't hit us.
Yeah, so just to clarify everything, man, this is one thing I'm really proud of, and it happened by mistake. We can talk about how it happened if you want, but it was a pretty cool process.
I'd love to hear it.
Everybody goes by their member numbers, so you'll have dudes that are out working, or traveling, or living their lives, and they'll check in on Instagram, or send me a text, or do whatever, and they'll check in, and they'll say, you know, like, HB75's checking in from Paris, and it's really cool, man. It created something that I did like from the military, and something that I obviously took away from it, but it created that brotherhood and that, like, connection with people. And we kind of created our own little squadron where we can have a fucking roll call, you know?
Yeah.
And in fact, that's what we should call it when we have a party. We'll do a Hollywood Brotherhood roll call in Vegas every year.
Woo!
Yeah, that would be awesome. And, you know.
But that was a total accident. That wasn't premeditated or planned.
Just the way it happened.
I put number one in the first ring that I made because I was really proud that I got it done. And that type of jewelry is something that I was really into already. And I probably had collected jewelry of other people's, other silversmiths, other companies and stuff for a decade, at least, maybe 2 decades. And it doesn't really matter, but I had probably blown $100,000 on other people's jewelry. And I was really proud that I got my own made. So when I made the first one, I put number one inside of it just because I wanted to remember that that was the first one I ever made. And then when I sold it to Brett, Brett's probably the reason we have the whole construct that we have, because he wanted to put his number in his. So we put it in his, and then people started asking, once a couple of us had them, hey, is number 9 spoken for? Is number 69 spoken for?
Nice.
My number is 231, so can I get that? And it kind of just happened from there. And now it's a thing. Now it's like the biggest part of the Brotherhood is everybody goes by their numbers and is like a close-knit community instead of just a dude that bought a ring from you.
You know? It's like a squadron coin almost, where you can see how many people have joined over the years and you know, kind of see that history. It kind of creates history in that business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. So when you make...
And just so anybody listening knows, not to steal that idea, we got a bunch of dudes in motorcycle clubs that are members, so don't take that idea.
You better... Yeah, I don't know if you can copyright that or patent that or something. But,
no, but they can enforce it. That's...
So I got to ask, when it came to the actual building or creation of this ring, were you able to do this entire process by yourself, or did you have to learn how to smith, or did you hire a smith? Like, who actually makes these rings?
So a little bit of all that, but I won't lie to you and tell you that I'm like Mr. Jack of all trades, and I do everything by hand by myself. That's absolutely not the case. I had this idea, and I worked on this design for probably 7 years before I actually made it happen. And I bought all the equipment. I had wax casting stuff. I had all the tools. I had an art studio. I've had an art studio in every house I've owned for the past 15 years or so. And I was planning on doing it all myself, but in the end, with the Air Force and teaching in the Air Force and flying and deployments, and then also when I got out as a contractor and stuff, I just never found the time to master every part of it myself. So I understand every part of it, but what I eventually made my peace with doing is I draw it, and then I this is also not standard for jewelry, so I'm kind of proud that this is the route we went down. It's also not something a lot of other guys are going to do because it's not the most straightforward way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that. I like doing it the right way versus the easy way. I draw it, and then I go work with a company that is AutoCAD experts, and we turn my drawing into a 3D AutoCAD file.
Okay.
And then I'm really into cars and bikes, and so I took another piece of automotive stuff that I knew, and I went to a company here in Vegas that can CNC cut stuff. So we CNC cut the AutoCAD drawing out of wax, the way you would make billet aluminum parts.
Mm-hmm.
So every wax is as perfect of a cut as you can get for the design, and then we make our molds, and then we do the old school lost wax casting method in a foundry here in Vegas.
Wow. Okay, so this is quite the process.
It's certainly not a quick process, and it's not easy, and I kind of went about it the long way around, but honestly, that's one of the things that I've become proud of, is because there's easier ways to do it, and there's certainly cheaper ways to do it. but none of them give you the same product that we've got. So
we have to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsor.
So how does somebody go about getting one of these rings? Do they go to HollywoodBrotherhood.com? How long does it take from placing an order to actually getting a ring?
Well, it used to be really fast, and then 2020 fucked up the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a little bit of a delay and a backlog right now. And I was thinking about it today, man. I still don't understand how that works. I don't understand. Yeah. I don't understand how COVID fucks up your timeline on casting raw silver, but it happens, and there's a delay in every part of the process. So it used to be that you could probably give me a call or find us on Instagram or Facebook or knock on the fucking door at 3 a.m. and I could make you a ring in the next couple days. But now the process is anywhere from a week to 4 months, depending on who you ask and when you ask. I won't let anybody wait 4 months, but with the way the world is right now, I do think that it might be a month to get a ring, depending on how backed up the casting house is, and you know what people's schedules are.
Right.
It might take a month and a half to get something.
I think that's fairly normal. I used to pump out t-shirts in like 3 days, and now it takes some of my customers like 4 weeks to get a shirt.
So I think
everyone's delayed right now.
Don't get it, man. I don't know how that works.
I
still can't in my mind make the connection between somebody having a cough and people not being able to pump out t-shirts faster than a month at a time.
I think it's I think the reason why business is slow right now is because they had to either reduce numbers, cut staff, or they have these mandates where they can only have so many people in a warehouse at one time or working at one time, and so what it does is it just reduces that production.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, that makes sense, and you're probably exactly right, man. But when we're talking about the jewelry and stuff, I'm never working with more than one or two people at any given time face-to-face.
Yeah.
So I still, it just blows my mind that the world ground to a halt so much. And I don't know. I'll get off my Jameson-infused soapbox on COVID here, but it just, God, it grinds my gears.
No, man, I think everyone's feeling exactly what you're feeling right now. So are you only on social media, or do you actually have a website?
No, there's a website. It's Hollywood Brotherhood Everything. So if anybody wants to find it, it's Instagram, Hollywood Brotherhood, Facebook, Hollywood Brotherhood, website, HollywoodBrotherhood.com.
Okay.
My cell phone is on there, so you can call me directly. It's not a major corporation where you're going to place an order online and never talk to anybody. Somebody called and ordered a ring maybe about a week ago, and he called me at home around about midnight, and by the time we got off the phone, it was like 2 a.m.
Okay.
We made a fucking new friend and instant connection, and that's kind of part of the company, you know? Like, we bullshitted for 2 hours. And the ring was almost secondary, man. I love to sell jewelry, and I love to make stuff, and I love that it's working and people like it. But now, you know, like, we just have one more member out there, and he knows he can call here and bullshit for 2 hours in the middle of the night if he wants to.
Well, I think that's a testament to the name. I mean, when you talk about brotherhood, you talk about people that you can talk to and rely on, and I think that really does kind of, you know, show that the company that you've created is more than that, and people aren't just a number. Even though their numbers on the ring, it's not just a number. You know, there's that sense of camaraderie and brotherhood, and I like that. So I think that's very unique.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, well,
I don't, there's explanations and flowery descriptions of everything on the website if you look through the menu. But I think we pretty much hit it already. You know, the fact that you understand the brotherhood side of it and how that kind of relates to where we came from and what we're used to from the Air Force, and flying and all that shit, and how it makes sense in our personal lives. I never fit in the Air Force that well. I'm not a military-minded guy. I spent most of my time in the Air Force teaching people to fly and trying to hide my tattoos and how long my hair was. But I still enjoyed it, man, and I enjoyed the camaraderie and the brotherhood and stuff. So really, I just took all the parts that I couldn't imagine doing without and just translated those into the business.
So let me ask you this. Since you're still flying RPAs and you're still deploying, how difficult is it to operate the business while you're overseas? Is there somebody back here taking care of shit for you? Or is it one of those things where you're just dealing with this while you're in whatever country?
A little bit of both, man. I'm still figuring it out. We make it work. I've never failed to follow through on an order or make somebody something custom, but it's mostly been me. But I've needed help along the way, especially when I'm deployed and stuff. The deployments and still flying as a contractor is a double-edged sword. It pays well. I know Yo said that she believes in the mission and stuff, and I do too. And I got fucking flags everywhere. I got a flag that I drive around with in my car every day. I got flags on every chair that I sit and write in. I got flags in my art studio and stuff, but don't let her fool you. She still has a shower in her master bathroom that spits out $100 bills. the deployments are a double-edged sword, man, because they do eat up a lot of your time. I'm only in the States for half a year to run a business like Hollywood Brotherhood, but at the same time, it makes it so the jewelry's not make or break. There's a lot of guys that there's a lot of silversmiths and jewelry companies that disappeared in 2020. And a lot of guys that were competitors of mine that are not doing well. Some of them ask me to buy their companies.
Wow.
I don't know if I should talk about who, because I don't want to piss anybody off, but I'm just going to have a drink of Jameson and then move on.
Yeah, you can leave that off. That's fine. I'll pivot.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll pivot here to Brett and Yo.
It's no big deal, man. But what I was going to say is it's nice because I still make good money as a contractor, and that funds the hobbies and the art and the jewelry and the clothing and all the stuff that we're doing. But it also is really valuable because it doesn't mean that the business is ever at risk of going under. I don't rely on Hollywood Brotherhood to pay for the mortgage, you know?
Right.
So it's going to be there, and anybody can always call up and get a ring, and I'm not at risk of going bankrupt or something like that.
Is the end game, though? Is the end game that you're eventually just going to be Hollywood Brotherhood? Is there any plan to eventually move on from being a pilot, or do you think that this side venture is just something that you're going to continue to do while you're contracting just because you enjoy it, but it's not the end-all be-all?
Yeah, I enjoy flying. Flying was never my life. I was not the type of dude that had always dreamed of being a pilot and just couldn't imagine doing anything else. I would probably do anything that paid the bills, but I do enjoy flying. So I have no plans of stopping unless I have to.
Mm-hmm.
I would do it for another 10 years if it exists, if contracts are good. I might not go back into the military and cut my hair and fly again. but I would certainly do it as a contractor anywhere I could.
Okay.
I
do have a question for Yo and Brett, and this will let you get a Jameson. So...
Thanks.
Yeah, no worries. So for Brett and Yo, you all both came in around 99, or at least into the program pre-2001. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
What did the program look like before 9/11? And I guess my question would be, why was there even a program before 9/11? I mean, what was it like back in 99 doing RQ1 shit?
Well, we were RQ1, Alphas and Bravos, and it was mainly just ISR. So we were just looking and watching and passing on information.
Yeah, this was all prior to arming the Predator.
Right.
So it was very similar. So we're in the grand scheme of things, we were imagery analysts with the intelligence community, and we were pulled directly into the RPA community. And so it was kind of like we were making our own imagery, which was very interesting. I've been shot down 3 times before we were armed. And each time I walked away and went and had a Starbucks, you know. and Yo here, we've known each other for a long time, so I think we both experienced the same kind of thing. We had to wait about a year until we got trained and then got into it that way.
Hey, sorry, can I mess up your podcast real quick? I just wanted to say I got shot down last night and then went and had Starbucks also.
Oh, okay. Well, the good thing was you were able to walk away from that one too. So
yeah, I limped away from it, but it was all right.
I'm not editing that out. That's gonna stay. Brett and Yo, I guess this is just more of my own intrigue, but what did that training even look like back then? I mean, geez, this has to be pre-PMATS. This is like MTT kind of shit. Like, how long did you go through training for this? And what did they even tell you the mission was? Because this is pre-Global War on Terror. So
we had no idea what we were getting into because we were both trained as imagery analysts. We were both in the same class in tech school. And it was literally a one-day, couple-hour training on what Predators were. And they sent us, they're like, hey, you're going to this place, and you're going to do this. But they really had no idea what we were doing. We had no idea what we were doing. And when we got to Indian Springs Auxiliary Field, as it was at the time,
mm-hmm.
we were behind several months. We just sat around trying to help with paperwork, and I volunteered to go to the Honor Guard just to do something. And
I remember that.
Then I went to Kuwait for a month just to do something and see things because we were so backlogged at the time. So once I came back, we finally went through training, and at the time we were just learning kind of what it was to be controlling the cameras, because what we were trained to do initially was definitely different compared to what we were actually doing.
Yeah, I was a trained imagery analyst too, so I got plucked, and so I know exactly. I had an idea of what I was supposed to go do, and then I got plucked to Preds, and I had no idea what the hell I was actually doing.
I never actually went into the world of imagery analysts and did it in the military. I just completely did Predator stuff.
Yeah.
Did you ever fly the RQs?
No, actually, when I got in, they had just switched to the MQ1s, and when I was in the FTU, I think I was still doing MTT trainers. I don't even know if the PMATs had existed yet. So
yeah, they did.
At the time, we did two students at a time. We were teaching a lot differently. I mean, it was a lot different. You did the entire program where you went from launch and recovery to mission. You mm-hmm. did everything.
Yeah.
And then yep. it changed later and you know, on, as you know, and it was just either LR or you were just doing a mission. So yeah, it's changed several times over the years.
The RQ cameras were different too. So we had, they weren't gimbal stabilized at all. We had to trim the cameras constantly to keep them on target. It was very difficult. We had a spotter camera that was amazing.
It was awesome. We were looking at the moon with it every now and then.
Yeah, it was a 900.
Awesome.
It was a 955mm zoom camera. I mean, you could read license plates from 18,000 feet. It was ridiculous.
Wow.
But the drift on it was terrible. Like, you always had to trim the camera to keep it steady.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult. It was hard.
Trim no longer exists now.
Yeah.
I know.
People know about.
No, and they don't. And I remember the first MQs, when they came out, and that trim, button was something that you had to learn because the damn ball drifted all over the place.
It was terrible.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
But that's how you knew that you could do the job. Like if you were able to trip the camera and keep it, like, let go of the stick and it would stay on target, you were a badass. there were certain people that couldn't do it. But they're still around today.
Yeah. Now, did you, the FTU, back when you came through, that already existed, right? That was mostly contractor driven? Were there military instructors when you came through in 99?
Yeah, there were.
Yeah, there were both.
Okay. So at some point, there was somebody that was an initial cadre in this platform at some point.
Yeah, it was probably around 96 or 97. They had Roving Sands. Was like the first initial, proof of concept for the plane, and I worked with a lot of the people who did that.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. So there was already an FTU established when you all came through.
Yeah, there was somebody else who always was part. He was part of the Army when it first came out as part of the concept and training people, and then he got out of the Army, retired. And then he is still currently at Creech.
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about. I think that's you're talking about Chuck.
Yep, Chuck.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
he's been around.
Yeah, he's still around.
Oh. Yeah, he is. I actually saw him recently. So, man, I mean, we all go back quite a ways. You two go back farther than anybody that I know. Yo, you go back farther than anybody that I know that's currently still doing the job. And so, my question to you, Yo, is what's your end game? Because you've been doing this job for essentially 21 years. You're still doing it. I know you care about the mission. Scarface. What'd you say, Brett?
Have you ever seen the movie Scarface?
Yeah, I have, but...
You remember when he's so goddamn rich he buys a tiger?
I don't know if that's my end game, but I really don't know it until the point where... I'm just completely tired. I still believe in the mission. I still enjoy the people I work with. And until that changes, I think I'll continue to do this.
Do you have any side ventures that you've worked on over the years? Anything that interests you to move forward with?
Not really, honestly. It's always been this. I mean, it was mainly getting my bachelor's degree, and then I got my master's degree, and it was always to have something to fall back on. Just in case... this ended or something changed, I would have something else I could do. But this has really always been it.
Yo. Hey, don't let her fool you, though. This is Elder again. We were talking about this before we started the podcast. She's really the brains of this group, this Holy Trinity, tonight. She has all the good ideas. She's helped with a lot of shit for Hollywood Brotherhood. She's the only smart one on the phone right now.
Yeah, Yo has been a constant for a long time, and it's Yo. Personally, I'm glad that you're still in it because I think a lot of young people can look up to you and respect what you've done and what you're still doing to this day. So, thank you from me.
Thank you.
So, I want to pivot here to another last section before we close it out. And I think that you three are actually probably a good group to talk to regarding this. For people in the community now that are young airmen or young lieutenants or whatever that are going through, what advice would you give them on moving forward? Regarding separation, if they wanted to do their own company, if maybe just to stay in, what kind of advice would you give to the young listeners out there right now that don't really know what they want to do and they're kind of at this crossroads? They're at that re-enlistment time.
Oh, that's a difficult one. Everybody's different. I personally, as I separated from the service, I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't actually have a contract job until my final day in the Air Force.
Wow.
So yeah, it was scary. but I got a job. So I think a lot what you have to think about is what you want your future to look like. Do you want to steer clear from everything military, or do you want to get into the contracting arena, which is gradually getting harder and harder? Mm-hmm. I tried getting into the RPA as a sensor operator again, and it just never worked out. I got a job for a company in southern Arizona that was flying smaller drones, but they essentially found out I had a VA disability rating, and they fired me for that. Nice. Which I think is illegal, and I could have sued them. But,
that's ridiculous.
Yeah. One of the things I would say is if you're active duty, make sure that your medical records are up to date. Make sure that if you have any issue, make sure they're in your medical records. It sounds like, you know, you're working the system and all that, but seriously, like, take care of the things that have affected you while you're in service. And make sure that you're compensated for that, because they'll forget you. They'll throw you right to the wolves if you don't take care of yourself.
I think that's a fair point.
Yeah. Oh, there's another
one. I heard one. What are you drinking?
Jameson and ginger ale.
Nice. All right, yo, you're up.
The biggest thing I would say is just to have a plan. Like Brett said, you don't want to wait till the last minute. When I got out, I started working for a helicopter company as a scheduler because I'd done scheduling in the military, but I was only making $9 an hour, and that hurt a lot.
Oh, my gosh.
So all I thought about was getting out and doing school. I didn't really think past what I needed to do there. So I did that for a couple months, and then somebody that was quitting the FTU called me and said, hey, I'm leaving, because at the time there was very, very few jobs, and they said, I'm leaving, you should put in your resume. And that's how you get a job. It's somebody knows you, or you know somebody. And they essentially pushed my resume, which was amazing. And that's how I got the job initially. So there was another person also vying for the job that was retiring. So I got hired part-time initially. So I got hired part-time, so I was doing both jobs at the time. I was working at the helicopter company still, scheduling people and driving vans, picking people up to take them to their ride at the helicopter company. And then on my days off, I was working on like a Wednesday and Thursday up at Breach as an instructor. So until I got a full-time position, did I stop working at the other place. I was doing both jobs and going to school, so it was really hard. I would just say have a plan. Make sure you know what you're going to do. Have something lined up before you stop doing what you're doing. No?
Yeah, that's good. And that's something that I think most people that have been on the show have passed on to other people getting out, is have a plan. Don't just separate and wing it, because it can really bite you in the ass. And if you can, get your education done ahead of time. So, okay. All right, Elder, you probably got your drink made by now. So What advice do you have for people that are separating with the hopes of going into their own business as an entrepreneur?
I will caveat my answer with the fact that you should probably not follow my lead. Don't follow my advice necessarily, because I am so fuzzy-brained my whole life that I just risk it, man. I've never hesitated to kind of do whatever I felt was right, and that's kind of what I did for the military too. I didn't honestly put a lot of thought into getting out, so maybe I just got lucky with timing. It could have been blind luck for all we know, but I vividly remember standing in the squadron at Holloman, talking to a dude that ended up starting a contracting company, and him saying, "Hey, if I land a contract and got a job for you, would you come give it a shot?" And I just kind of on the spur of the moment said, "Yeah, man, I'll fucking try it." And I got out, and I kind of got out after 13 years and didn't look back, and just tried it. did the same thing with Hollywood Brotherhood. I just wanted to do it, and at the first opportunity I had, I just fucking did it. I spent a lot of time designing the rings and agonizing over how to make them right and how to get it right and how to do it. But I got the copyright, founded the company, built a website, talked to the lawyers, and did all that shit in like a week, and just made it happen. I think that's a double-edged sword, though, because I could easily see doing all that and having it fall through in the first month. So I feel like everything is luck of timing. And I do put a lot of effort into what I do, but I've always just gotten lucky. And I try to put a lot of hard work into what I do, but it just has so far seemed to work and not bit me in the ass. I do think that guys should do a serious calculation before they get out. It's just I didn't. I just kind of did what you said, which is probably the worst thing to do, and I just fucking winged it.
Yeah, but the difference is you whole-assed it.
Hey, I will say that, man. I don't mean to like talk myself up or try to sound cocky or something, but whenever I do something, I go all in. Even though I kind of just like take whatever opportunity is in front of me, I like make it my whole life when I do it. So that's kind of what Hollywood Brotherhood became. It's like it's everywhere, man. It's like on people's tattoos, and it's like all over the house and the cars and like the social media. It's pretty much the only thing I post on Facebook, so it's like my whole identity now.
I was going to touch on that. You are, in my opinion, a marketing genius. The way you present your company on social media, the pictures that you do are fantastic. You just, I don't, and I have to ask this question, but you just got like a 3,000-pound fucking Optimus Prime statue at your house.
Yeah.
Dude, where the hell did you even get that, and how?
You can see it on Instagram for Hollywood Brotherhood if you want to go check it out. I got a lot more pictures I got to go post, but I figured we got a new house. It's a nice place. It's big enough for me to have my own art studio and jewelry studio in the guest house out back. So I figured any respectable jewelry company needs a fucking mascot. So we bought a 12-foot-tall, 3,000-pound Optimus Prime made out of old car parts. Getting him into the yard was a fiasco. We had to get like I think they said it was a 200-foot, 60-ton crane or something, shut down half the neighborhood to get him into the backyard.
It's unbelievable. How did you even like? Who was someone selling this, or did you just come up with this idea and go, you know, I want this in my house?
Yeah. So I won't say the name of the company.
That's fine.
I don't want to piss anybody off, but there is an expensive company that makes super cool custom shit like that, and I'm also a sucker for auctions and good deals. So they had one that they had at a casino for sale for like the price of a truck for a long time, and they didn't sell it, so I bought it from the auction house that they sold it to. I paid the price of a used truck instead of a new truck. But it was a good deal, relatively speaking, and now it's part of Hollywood Brotherhood. So
that's awesome.
So he's the new mascot, and he's gonna have Hollywood Brotherhood all over him soon.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And we'll probably make a ring out of it too.
I think an Optimus Prime ring would be badass, dude. And I am a huge.
If I'd be allowed to make an Optimus ring, but I can make an Autobot Hollywood Brotherhood security guard ring.
Yeah, maybe Hasbro will probably try to find a way in there, but
if Hasbro's still around,
I know that's why. That's why there's a risk.
Speaking of like '80s cool toys, I did want to say you were talking to Brett and Yo about 1996 to 99, and I was still riding Hot Wheels around naked at the time.
To be honest, he still doesn't.
Yeah.
That's all right. We'll save that for the webcam, the YouTube channel. All right, guys. I appreciate all three of you coming on tonight and just giving me insight into questions that I had, especially with the beginning programs, the RQ1 stuff. Elder, talking about your Hollywood Brotherhood process and your company and all that. I've always been fascinated by that. And
thank you, man.
I loved having you all on the show. You all did a great job. So we're pretty much out of time. We've already gone over our hour mark, but that's okay because the show was great. So if you all just want to basically say cheers to everyone that listens to this, you know, whatever 20 people are going to hear this. And for anyone out there that's interested, check out HollywoodBrotherhood.com or Hollywood Brotherhood on Instagram and Facebook. And yeah, cheers. Thank you, everybody, for being on here.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Don't forget, we have t-shirts available on Hollywood Brotherhood as well.
Yeah, nice. I'm sorry. I forgot to mention that. Brett is now in charge of all the clothing for the company and everything. And he's a fucking genius with that. So he is not just the first brother. He is like the integral part of keeping me motivated and moving forward. Yeah, thank you, Kelso. I appreciate you talking to us and supporting Hollywood Brotherhood a little bit too. That's cool, man.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. All right, everybody, signing off and cheers.
See you, brother.